I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Poshnosh Gal, and today I'm joined by the legendary chef Oli Dabou. Born in Kuwait, Oli's worked in some of the finest and most spectacular kitchens in the world. He burst onto the London scene with the highly acclaimed Dabou restaurant in 2012, and now has Hyde, one of the most incredible restaurants in the capital, famed for both its stunning interior architecture and its Michelin-starred cuisine. Hi, Oli, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing really, really well. And so pleased that, you know, restaurants are open and we're out and we're able to dine. And
yeah,
it's been reopened for a while now. How's it been doing?
Yeah, no, very well, actually. So we reopened on the 4th of July, which was the earliest possible opportunity. Felt like reopening the business again, because it's such a big operation here. We went from having, I think, six of us in the kitchen on a day back up to, you know, maybe sort of 30 odd in the kitchen, and same with the front of house, because a lot of the senior guys had stayed at Hyde to do the Hideaway, the home delivery service that we did throughout lockdown. But that was quite a different offering. So, it was surreal going from, you know, maybe eight of us in a 14,000 square foot site back to close to a full team. But no, it was really lovely to get the brigade back together again, see familiar faces, and also to serve food on tableware. You know, obviously we've been doing it takeaway and Tupperwares, but there's nothing like, you know, doing the, you know, the top end food that is what we, you know, we kind of lights our fire as such.
Talk to us about what you felt during the closure period, and how did you deal with things at the time?
It was obviously a big blow to take initially, shutting the restaurant. But, you know, I think we took pride in our Darwinistic approach, how we evolved into, I think, a very polished home delivery offering very quickly. I think there was 2-day gap from the restaurant shutting to us relaunching with Hideaway. We got our hands on sort of whatever vehicles we could, and a lot of the front of house team works as drivers. We kept on our senior chefs in the kitchen to do the food. I mean, there's probably the most overqualified team during lockdown. Everyone would chip in and do the floor, wash up, whatever was needed. It was really a skeleton team, but personally I was grateful to have a sense of purpose. It made lockdown go more quickly, and it actually, I think, gave Hyde a slightly different audience. So some people that maybe didn't come to the restaurant did order our food and have since come back to the restaurant since. So, and also won us some new fans, and also I think galvanized the relationship we enjoy with our existing regulars, who, you know, were keen to have a window of luxury, you know, brought into their home at a time when there are very few luxuries going.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also got to see you sharing some recipe tips, and that was brilliant.
It was
excellent.
Yeah, I think there was an evolving or possibly devolving various hairstyles as it grew and got more and more feral and unkempt. But I don't do huge amounts of TV or social media, but I think anything that can improve people's life a little bit at times like that is a good thing, and food is a massive part of that, and is just trying to showcase simple recipes where just a little bit of know-how, you know, might provide a bit of inspiration or help them achieve a better result. But there's a zero production costs or value on the filming.
So let's just take you back, Oli. So you grew up in Kuwait. What was your childhood like out there, briefly?
It was early years, so they're sketchy memories as such. But Yeah, various things I remember. From food side, I think they're flatbreads. They cooked a lot of flatbreads on the side of the road. Also, bizarrely, roast chickens. They were amazing. Just from street vendors as well. I did enjoy Middle Eastern food, and there's some good stuff available there. A lot of the other restaurants were just very Western restaurants. But obviously remember the heat, and you know, which is pretty insane. But also the warm water. You can go into the sea, so warm. You know, you can just walk straight in. It's sort of complete opposite, say Cornwall or somewhere. And I remember a big Toys R Us as well. There's a huge Toys R Us there, and they used to dye the grass or paint the grass on the motorway. You'd have these strips of kind of blue grass or yellow grass. It's bizarre, the things that you remember. But I was a young kid back then, and I think 9 years old was the. I didn't go back to Kuwait after the war in 1990. That's when my dad left then, because he worked out there as an architect. He did go back later on, but it was at a time when I'd probably already left home and was busy cooking. Right. So I do remember it. I remember it fondly, but a long time ago now.
And what was the catalyst that got you into cooking? I mean, was that a period where you know, you kind of developed an interest into it, or was it when you came here?
I think just loved eating, loved my food. I think that's the most honest reason to, well, I wouldn't say become a chef, but to start cooking as a hobby. It's just that kind of innocent, pure enjoyment of food. And also when I met my English grandparents for the first time in the UK, they brought some sweets and some fudge. And I think my mum always encourages us to eat very healthily, so it was always just fruit or carrots or raisins or stuff like that. And then I remember having, you know, confectionery for the first time. And that kind of got me into baking. So I think that was the first step, was baking cakes or whatever. It was actually profiteroles. I think I might have had them and really enjoyed them. And then I'll make a batch myself, basically, was my outlook. And then it went from there.
Well, that's so funny. You've gone from completely healthy eating to then, like, you know,
chocolate and cream. yeah. But also, I think as a kid, there's more alchemy in pastry. You know, when you cook with meat or fish, you're transforming like raw chicken into, say, a cooked roast chicken, whereas with baking, it's a butter, sugar, eggs, flour becoming a cake. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit more, you know, sort of explicit kind of magic happening as such.
Right. And so, I mean, from that point, I mean, moving much, much more forward, you took your own initiative and you wrote a letter to Rowley Lee at Kensington Palace, who gave you your first unpaid work experience.
Yeah, it was, kind or foolish of him, but I was probably more damaged than good back then. But every kitchen needs a donkey, and I was happy to fulfill that role. I've always loved the atmosphere of the kitchen, that the crash bang wallah, very different schoolboy, his regular classroom environment. So really enjoyed working in the kitchen there. Also, just the quality of the produce they had was completely different to what was available back then. For me, cooking at home as a hobby. Yeah. So, no, it was really fun. I remember the first flat I stayed in was they had a little star flat in Notting Hill that was a great location, really good fun. So, yeah, it was fun. It was fun staying there. And I think, you know, the food he did back then was very progressive in, you know, how modern and stripped back it was, but full of flavour, and also served at a price point that was attractive to the customers. I was 16 then. I was still at school, but whatever kind of holidays I had, I'd cook if I could.
Well, Amazing. And so you worked in Guy Savoy in Paris as well after that, right?
Yeah, so that was I was 17 then. It was when France won the World Cup in 98. No, amazing. Again, on my holidays, I was studying French A-level at the time. So yeah, Camus and Truffaut and those kind of things. And it helped. Yeah, it did help. So yeah, there was no one English there. I was just speaking French for a full 6 weeks or whatever it was, and at an amazing time. You know, you could see, it was funny, you know, if you're French at that time, you'd hope that France would win the World Cup, but as a foreigner there, it just felt completely preordained. I know it's all about cooking, not football, but it was interesting for me as an outsider, just like, yeah, these guys, you know, from very early on, it was like, yeah, these guys are gonna win it. But yeah, it was an amazing night of celebration. I think, you know, hazy memories, but the kitchen the next day was worse for wear. You know, everyone turned up having been out all night. I don't think anyone had been to bed really, but yeah, it was an interesting morning, that morning, seeing everyone at work.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, that was quite a long time ago though. So your first job in kitchen started at Le Manoir. I mean, did you simply just apply there? How did you get the foot in the door?
Yeah, again, just applied. You know, every kitchen needs someone to, you know, pick spinach, peel potatoes, do the mundane jobs. And yeah, I wanted to work from the bottom up. I hadn't been to catering college. And I thought Le Manoir was as good a place to learn as any. I applied. They didn't have a position for me straight away, but I think 1 or 2 weeks later, I got the call, and as soon as I got that, you know, just drove up with whatever few possessions I had, and you know, subjugated my existence to working there and to learning on the job, and it's, yeah, one of the best decisions I've made.
Amazing. And what was Raymond Long like to work with?
No, he's an amazing guy. I mean, my relationship with him now is very different to what it was when I first started. I mean, he's almost looking at him like an uncle now. He's everything you want him to be when you meet him. Yeah, passionate, sociable, warm-hearted, big-hearted. He's a real force of nature, and he does drive energy into all the projects that he propels. So no, it was amazing. It was amazing working for him. And also with Gary, his head chef, he's incredibly methodical, incredibly organized. And, you know, it's one thing making one delicious plate of food. It's another thing to replicate them again and again and again by a brigade that is, you know, determined and you know, happy to work hard. So, you know, it wasn't just the creative side that I learned there or the fundamentals of cooking. It was also, I think, resilience and organization as well. So now I left feeling I started there feeling like I didn't deserve to be there, and when I left, I felt like I'd be able to walk into any brigade and hold my own. So no, it was probably the most formative experience that I've had was my time there.
Do you have any stories that you can share? What's your fondest memory of working in the kitchen?
Of Le Manoir, well, basically, when anyone left on their last day, they'd always get thrown into the pond, and it was funny because you'd see, was that, yeah, no, you see all these, you know, probably relatively well-off people enjoying a lovely dinner, and then in the background there'll be a kind of motley crew or press gang of chefs with one of them wriggling in the middle. And it was kind of brutal, you know, whether you had your phone on you, whether you had your, you know, I've seen like one guy, when he got thrown in, his shoe went miles away. You know, if you skimmed the bottom of Le Manoir Pond, there'd be a lot of marker pens, shoes and mobile phones. But,
well, what did you leave behind?
Hopefully good memories, but no, nothing. I knew it was coming, so I had... I'd kept my mobile phone in my locker, and I think, and actually, I vacuum packed the contents of my pockets. I knew I was coming.
That is brilliant. So from that, you went on to work at some phenomenal places, for example, Noma in Copenhagen, Lestrance in Paris, Heston's Fat Duck, Mugeres in Spain, Hibiscus with Claude Bossi. And you've had such amazing experience behind you. Do you believe that working with the best brings out the best in you?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, cooking's too tough a career to, you know, to not give everything or do your best. So I think, you know, it's a bit like take up boxing or mixed martial arts or something. If you do it, you know, you subjugate yourself to that role while you're learning. And yeah, I think, you know, from everyone's different stylistically, everyone likes different things. I just would either, you know, work or stage at places where I enjoyed their style of cooking or thought there was something I could take from it. Yeah, some of the places are more classic or more progressive, but I think it's interesting to see a spectrum. And I do think unless you are pushed to a degree, you won't fully know or reach your potential. And that's probably two ways. That's one, working for others, and two, working for yourself. And you work for yourself and you've got your reputation and investment, all these things on the line, you know, then that gets the best out of you too. But, you know, there can be, yeah, it can be a sociable lifestyle, but I do think, you know, there is a kind of brutal meritocracy to cooking, in that you get what you give. The harder you work, the smarter you work, the more you'll get out of it. That's 100% accurate.
I mean, and that's great advice. I was going to ask you, what is your advice to budding chefs? But that's great.
Don't do it. No, I'd say it's got to be the only thing you want to do, not something you want to do. Right. If it's, I want to be a teacher or I want to be a chef, it needs to feel vocational and undeniable.
Right. And what are the kind of qualities that you look for when recruiting your own staff?
Yeah, I'd say it's the things that you can't teach. So firstly, a positive manner is probably the first thing I look for. Someone that I think I can work alongside for many hours of the day and is also going to be relatively self-sufficient emotionally, should we say. The next one is a love of food and curiosity. Yeah, you want people to love food and to really kind of want to know more. The skills we can teach. Palate can evolve as well, but you want people to have you don't want to be kind of starting from scratch, or for people to have, you know, bad pre-existing palate or bad pre-existing technique. So, you know, I've got no qualms with people very inexperienced entering the kitchen. It's you know, I'd rather mold someone from scratch than start with a sort of, you know, preordained thought if it isn't aligned with what we do at Hyde.
I mean, your first head chef role was at Texture in Portman Street.
Yeah.
What did it feel like to finally have that responsibility of running your own menu?
Well, I didn't have full responsibility of the menu then. It was obviously Aggie's, Agnar Sverenson's.
Right, of course.
His restaurant. I was there to, I guess, you know, just as I've got head chefs, to implement his sort of desires and cooking. I'd come up with dishes, but they'd always be done with a view to being right for Texture. I knew his likes and dislikes, and, you know, often he'd come up with dishes, or he'd set me to work on a dish, and it would always be with a view to befitting, you know, Texture's identity. That said, I really enjoyed defining the culture of the kitchen as a head chef. That is an imprint you can have. So being methodical, being organized, being fair, all those kind of things. And no, it was lovely to be finally in London. Obviously, I'd worked in a lot of places. They were all over Europe and, you know, sometimes in the countryside. And London's always felt like, as it felt like home. And as we said at the beginning, I worked a little bit in Kuwait, but then I went to school near Guildford. And yeah, it was, you know, 40 minutes train ride from London. So it was not all my friends were in town. And yeah, it was nice to be in London again. And yeah, it was nice to have that feeling of pride, you know, setting somewhere up, albeit not my own restaurant, doing it, you know, with friends and people that you respect.
You were briefly at the Cuckoo Club. I guess this was the final of your own solo venture, which was debut in 2012. How did the opportunity present itself, or did you create that opportunity then to start out on your own?
I worked at Cuckoo because I needed a job that I could do whilst fundraising, finding a site. It was also there that I met Oscar, who's my business partner for debut. And I was going to say, it was basically just had a blank canvas, hadn't done a fundraiser before, but yeah, you just crack on with it. There's probably mistakes that you make along the way, but, you know, can argue with the end result. It took probably 2 years from, you know, typing the first words to opening the restaurant. Had a clear idea of how I wanted it to be, and I think I conveyed that in the business plan. But, you know, as a young chef, you're not surrounded by people with money to invest. That's sort of a slightly different world. And also there's you know, creating that sense of momentum and getting the money, getting the site, you know, was a massive ask. And it was, you know, took a huge amount of energy. And yeah, you really had to force it into existence. I'd found probably about 20 people that would be keen to invest, you know, what would probably be considered relatively small amounts today. But you know, crowdfunding didn't exist then. I had no following or PR, and this was very much people taking a punt based on them liking the sound of the restaurant and where I'd worked before. I think, you know, obviously with the back then, I think there hadn't been restaurants as stripped back that did as polished or as innovative food. You're either going to, you know, somewhere that was quite, you know, quite bourgeois to enjoy a sort of fine dining, or you'd go to a members club, or, you know, somewhere trendy that would serve overpriced steaks or Pan Asian food. You know, there wasn't that sweet spot in the middle that now is actually relatively commonplace. So it was hard because, you know, aside from getting the money, getting the site, you know, when there isn't a positive outcome on the horizon, you have to remain positive. And 2 years is a long time, you know, to do so. You get knockbacks, you know, for the 20 people that didn't invest, there's probably, you know, that did invest, there's probably five times that didn't. So, you know, I sort of had a scattergun approach, you know, and thought I'd fire out the investment pack to anyone and everyone. You know, it's a bit like taking a machine gun to a clay pigeon shoot, you know, emptying the tank and hopefully you get something. adopted that attitude. But when I was working in the nightclub, I mean, it was fun, but, you know, you're scratching your head thinking, look, when and where am I going to be able to do my own thing? And it's a long period of time to remain positive for, but we got there in the end.
Yeah, well, you had backers which included family and friends, so you must have felt a lot of extra pressure given the close relationships.
Completely different kettle of fish to say if you're backed by a private equity firm or somewhere where you know, they're probably speculating a bit more, and yeah, for everyone it was really an emotional investment as much as a financial one. And yeah, well, it was pressure on me, and you know, aside from you know, the inherent pressures of running a restaurant or setting up a restaurant, to do one on such a tiny budget, and then, you know, were to be accountable for that budget to friends, family, you know, friends of friends. It wasn't, you know, money coming from a, you know, hugely deep pocket. It was, you know, real money for real people. So yeah, that did make it all the more spicy, should we say, for me. Yeah, we set up on a shoestring. I think the kitchen came to 70,000. And yeah, whatever we could to get it over the finish line. We had four teapots when we opened, and then as soon as we had cash flow, we got some more in. At one point, I was down to £6,000 in our account, waiting for VAT rebate to come in from all the building work. So that's not a lot of money when you got, you know, salaries to pay. But luckily, you know, we opened, and yeah.
Oh, I mean, you had Bay Mashler from the Evening Standard gave you rave reviews, 5 stars to be precise. Do you think that's what kicked it all off? It was all, you know, it was Giles Corran as well and Jay Ray.
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, 100% Faye that started the snowball. And then, right. Yeah, I think it was, I can't remember if it was Giles next, then A. Gill, who wrote an incredible piece, and Metro, I think, as well. There's, you know, I think 4 or 5 five-star reviews. They're also really lovingly written, and you know, as much as I'd love to claim it being all the food, I think it was also just the lack of, you know, BS, and we're probably the first restaurant that came on the scene not trying to be perfect. It was sort of value authenticity or flaws above perfection. I'm not saying that we tried to make mistakes, but it was more a case of that there wasn't this sort of masquerade of perfection that you get in some bourgeois places that can end up in a very sterile kind of night. Where, you know, we wanted it to feel fun, inclusive. And I'd always tell the front of house, feel like you're hosting a party. You know, when the customers come in, you know, treat them like, you know, they're coming into your own home. Also price point, I think the value for money we came in, I'd like to think the quality was as good as anywhere you could get in London. But yeah, I think the price point was key for us, and a sense of, you know, passing some of that saving on to the customer. You know, there are no flowers, no tablecloths, you know, no luxuries in general. So, you know, wanted it to feel like when the customer got the bill, that was the cherry on top of their experience, was something less than they expected.
Right, and I mean, you got a Michelin star within the first few months of service. Was that one of your objectives?
It wasn't. I probably would have felt, I wouldn't say hard done by, but I knew the star, I knew the food we were serving. I was there every service, I think for the first 2.5 years. So I knew what we were serving. I was very proud of it. It wasn't an objective per se, and I thought because we were so stripped back, there was a chance that we might not get one, but I was very grateful to them that they appreciated the quality on the plate rather than the cost of the decor.
And I mean, so did the success of Dabu lead you to Barnyard and Henrietta?
I guess in some ways, I mean, Barnyard was three of our initial investors that wanted to set up somewhere kind of fun and no frills. And for me, it was fun doing something that we couldn't do at Dabu. You know, I love that kind of cooking, but it isn't something that I love to eat on my days off, and something that I enjoy to make, but it's not something that I could do at Dabu. And then, yeah, the Henrietta Consultancy came about because the guys at Experimental Cocktail Club, I think they'd been to the restaurant a few times. Right. And yeah, we you know, they asked if I was keen, and you know, we got on pretty much straight away. And you know, I've never wanted every restaurant I'm involved in to be a Temple of Gastronomy. So those Stéphane Barnard and Henrietta provided, I guess, a more kind of entry level or less sort of gastronomic avenue for me to kind of enjoy creatively.
All three closed in quite quick succession, actually. Yeah. Was it because of Hyde that you shot them all?
Yeah, it was, you know, Hyde, we do on a busy day, you know, 600 covers. When we opened, there was, you know, about 150 staff across the different floors. There's, yeah, you got breakfast, brunch, set lunch, tasting menu, an a la carte on ground, a serious kind of tea list, coffee lists, vast amounts of tableware. I mean, it's a huge operation. It's kind of like a hotel without rooms. So, yeah, it was just a case of having every single good pair of hands I could alongside me, and also for me to have, I guess, the clarity of thought to be able to come up with an amazing, I guess, a reinvention or new identity for the food that would become synonymous with Hyde. Not just for the opening menu, but, you know, as we evolve and get better. So it was such a big project and probably such a unique project that it was one that I didn't want to compromise my efforts on. I didn't want any pre-existing establishments I had to suffer as a result. And there were opportune exits for, you know, or things that would work that for each of the pre-existing businesses or, you know, consultancies. So yeah, I mean, the thought process was to do less and do, you know, which would enable me to do it better.
You must have been hesitant though, because Daboo was so successful.
Yeah, less than people think in some ways. I think the fact that we'd achieved everything we could so quickly in that space made me more comfortable with the decision. I felt in the 5 or 6 years we'd taken it as far as it could go, and you know, you either think, well, I'm either going to do this for another 10 years, obviously it was going along nicely, but also the walls were creeping in on me because we had such little funding when we opened. It was, you know, from an operational point of view, it was hard doing what we did because we had such little space and such little resources. So yeah, you get shown a shiny new site in Mayfair, and you know, it was a challenge, and I just felt like it was the right time to do something different. And it's nice to show you're not a one-hit wonder, that you can, you know, do something different and do it well. And, you know, it was sad shutting Daboo, but it was the right choice. But, you know, it was an amazing leaving party as well. It was probably one of my memorable nights, and it just felt, it was almost like a wedding, one of these kind of slightly euphoric, very boozy celebrations. I mean, we filled the place with all our regulars. It was kind of invite only almost for the last night, and yeah, I think I left about 7 in the morning, you know, having been there about 24 hours. So it was an amazing night, and it was nice to end on your terms as well. You know, I'd much rather do it that way and have, you know, nothing but fond memories of the place.
Yeah. Bang, amazing. So let's talk about Hyde. First of all, what a stunning space. I absolutely love it. The staircase is everything. It's a piece of art. Was it crafted on site, or was it built off site and then assembled on site?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. It was, I think, the first thing that was designed and the last thing that was actually completed. So it was coming in Shoreditch that did the design. It was made in Poland, start to finish in a warehouse. There's a metal skeleton within, and it's aged composite oak on the outside. It got shipped in, I think there's 3 main parts, but there's 15 different shades of stain, of wood stain from light to dark that hopefully you kind of don't notice. So, I mean, the whole thing is absolutely amazing.
Stunning.
And sad thing is I've got used to it now because I see it nearly every day. So when I walk into work, but I think it's nice to do something unique in a crowded market and unique that isn't gimmicky or crying for attention. It's design that warrants attention rather than kind of screaming for it.
And how much did you play with the interiors?
Played some role. I mean, obviously we had interior designers and Evgeny and Tatiana, were key to it because they had an idea for what they were after, and obviously Evgeny was funding it. So I think that allows you
a lot more freedom,
a lot of decision making. But I think the key for all of us was something that wasn't bling, that wasn't a kind of an ode to Mayfair opulence, and for us as well as a sense of space. You know, we always felt there's no luxury without space, and space in London is a rarity. Means you can relax a little bit more. If you're relaxed, it means you're probably more open to what you're going to be served and just enjoy the experience all together in a different manner. So I think that those elements were key, and we saw eye to eye on, and then it's nice having little kind of quirky little touches. I think the layers of attention to detail within Hyde are unparalleled, from the flooring to the type of soap in the bathroom to the little metal finishers, the napkin rings, there's thought into every little detail and consideration. And like I said, we wanted it to feel ultimately like the best possible home rather than kind of walking into a kind of showy restaurant.
Yeah, and I was running out of battery because I'd taken so many pictures of the staircase. And and there's a little drawer in the dinner table.
I mean, like I said, we see 180 customers, and if imagine if 10% needed their phone charging, that's 18 phones all probably look the same at reception. Also, people can feel a little bit naked without their phone, and also just means they can, if they are if they are expecting urgent calls or whatever, that they're not hamstrung. So it's like with a restaurant, you want to anticipate people's needs before they need it. So I think those things show due consideration.
Yeah. When you set the bar so high, where do you go from there?
I think I have just have fun with other things. We're doing a permanent hideaway on Mount Street. So that's completely different production values. The Hyde is kind of like the naughty sibling, very small, very cute. So you can do amazing coffees and croissants.
Amazing.
Roll, champagne and oysters, and quite vintage style pastry. So whereas at the moment everyone's doing kind of, type 2 diabetes inducing sugary pink fluff, they will take a slightly more sophisticated route. But now looking forward to opening that. Just finished doing photo shoot for my cookery book. That'll be out next September. So we've been busy. Also, we do a consultancy for Cromwell Place. So it's a new members club and gallery space in South Kensington. So literally just down the road. So that's, again, beautiful architecture. I think it's quite interesting. It'll be quite new for the art scene to almost, I would say, hot desk, but you can have either an office or a gallery space. So again, you don't have the financial burden of having a gallery 52 weeks of the year. You can have one for a couple of weeks during freeze or whenever it may be. And the members will have food that I'm working on with a team there. So yeah, plenty to keep us busy. So there's no desire to do more hides, but I think, you know, there's other projects that we can do, and it's nice doing things that feel independent, working with other brands that also have a similar level of sophistication, attention to detail, kind of desire for quality. So yeah, I think I'd only ever want one hide. I mean, it's an absolute beast.
I'm not on your plate. I had no idea that you were doing all these other projects. Mm. Are they in collaboration with Yevgeny?
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously less involved. I mean, he's not involved at all in my cookery book. That's a domestic cookbook, and as good as a home cook he is, he's not involved in that. Obviously, Hideaway is you know, under the same umbrella, and the Crumble Place is that's obviously via Hyde and Hedonism. So there'll be the ability to get I think bottles from Hedonism to be delivered to Crumble Place. Hedonism's going to be doing the wine list as well. It's all correlated.
And such an amazing collaboration between yourself and Yevgeny. How did the relationship come about?
He'd come to the restaurant a few times. I think hopefully liked what he had. And no, just emailed me out the blue. Yeah, I saw the site, met with him. Yeah, we got on straight away. I like the fact that, yeah, there's very few people that are quality driven, you know, to his extent. You know, usually it'll be, you know, looking at the bottom line or cutting corners to, you know, to enable that bottom line to be healthier, rather than the mindset of let's create the best possible product, you know, you know, if it's good enough, we'll do well. So, you know, the driving force or the behind the decision making is what's best. It's not what's best value, or it's what's what's going to be the most profitable. It's the restaurant's one that, you know, I mean, there's serious investment behind it, and I think it's one that attracts people that are going to want, you know, that want the best food, the best wine. It was nice working with someone that's kind of that mindset and quite perfectionist. I mean, we can be more different in many ways, but I think in some ways we're quite similar as well.
Yeah, well, speaking of perfectionist, I mean, Hyde is I'm going to say again, it's just such a stunning venue. But it used to be an old car showroom that could get a car lift.
Yeah, back in the day, and some nice ceilings and the car lift.
Do you use it?
It does get used. So people can use it, and they can also, in theory and in practice, you can enter through the car lift, get dropped off in the private dining room that has its own toilet facilities, and then you can leave at the end of the meal. So you can be completely secluded should you want that level of privacy. And there are people that do. It's there to be used.
And you've got some exquisite private dining rooms as well: the reading room, the broken room, and the shadow room.
Yeah, that's great. I'm in one of them. I'm in Seek at the moment. You got Hide and Seek and above, but they seat from 4 up to 24. Obviously, that's capped at the moment due to COVID. I think when you have a big space, it's really key to have flexibility. So if we need to offer something for everyone, so whether it's coffee and a croissant for you and a friend, or, you know, boardroom dinner celebrating a deal, you know, you need that flexibility to fill 160, 180 seats, you know, every day.
I'll just run through a little bit for not everyone that has been to the space who don't know. Yeah. Hide Below is the basement bar with record-breaking wine list. Hide Ground is casual all-day dining, and Hide Above is your fixed tasting menu. And I've experienced both Hide Ground and Hide Above. Absolutely love both experiences. How much thought went into making sure the two dining experiences were very different from one another?
Yeah, I mean, that was key. We wanted clear differentiation, not just for ourselves, but in the various guides as well, because that spreads a message to the public that they are two distinct operations that happen to be under the same roof. Like I said, Ground, you can have a coffee and a croissant, or you can have grazing, a single course, or you can have a full blowout, you know, three-course dinner. And it's seen as the brasserie, but I think the quality and the consistency there is probably the thing I'm almost proudest of at Hyde, because it's the thing that's perhaps the hardest to achieve. I think to cook for that number of people as consistently as we do, breakfast, lunch, dinner, is a real testimony to Josh Angus and all the team and in Hyde Ground. I think it's homely, it's buzzy, it's less potentially less conceptual in terms of the food. You know, when you go there, you look at the menu, you kind of know what you're going to get. I say that, I do think people will be significantly happily surprised with the quality of execution. But then Above is maybe a bit more of an experience, a little bit more of a journey across, the multiple courses. Want people to kind of surrender, put themselves in our hands, and just enjoy the best produce, very sensitively handled. And with tasting menus, it's not, I like them because, they're a celebration of what's in season, not because they're a means for the kitchen to showcase the latest technique. I hate kind of chef-y driven tasting menus. For me, the best thing about tasting menus is, like, say you go on a holiday abroad and they just cook what's best, what's local, and you don't choose. I prefer the same kind of sensation when they eat at Hyde. So it just feels very organic, very effortless, even though there's a huge amount of effort that does go into it. It's different. Yeah, they're two very different experiences, and you might get people that prefer one to the other. But like I said, you need a bit of diversity within the operation to fill such a big space.
Yeah, absolutely. And how much you mentioned that you've got amazing chefs working there. How much time do you spend in the kitchen yourself?
Varies on the days and weeks. I mean, I always come up with the dishes and then train the guys to do them, and we cook them for front of house. I think the core of my energy is on coming up with the dishes and sort of defining the menu with the seasons. It's a big job. I mean, we're moving into autumn at the moment, so because there's such a big offering on the different floors, when you do a menu change, it's quite a staggered affair, because if you change everything at once, the wheels are going to fall off. So you need to do a few dishes in Above, then a few dishes in Ground, a few dishes in Above, a few more in Ground, pastries, bread baskets, blah, blah, blah. So I think my role is effectively making sure that the dishes are as good as they can be and that they befit the Hyde DNA. And then, I've been working on the menu for Hideaway at the moment. I mean, I'll cook on some of the busiest services or be on the pass, but I was going to say, it's a sort of role where if I'm there peeling potatoes, then it's not a good use of my time, and it takes a while to realise that. Initially, you want to be at the coalface, and you are, at Dabu, before we opened, I was writing prep lists for everyone, because all the dishes were new. And at Hyde, we had a test kitchen, and I was training a senior team, and then they train sous chefs, and the sous chefs train the, you know, it's kind of filtered down. One person can't train a brigade of 60.
Right.
You know, but actually, if I train, you know, what, you know, another five people, then they train another 10. You've suddenly got 15 people, and then that's a ratio of one teacher to three people rather than one teacher to 60 people. So that there's it's more trickle down effect in a bigger kitchen. So for me, it's making sure the head chefs have got everything they need to you know, to run their respective brigades and cook the dishes well. It's for me to instill the culture. And yeah, then, I mean, I'll, you know, sometimes, I was going to say just, yeah, help with bits and bobs or, you know, whatever's needed, or whether they need more equipment, more tableware, working on new dishes, whatever it may be. I mean, there's always something going on, private dining room, you know, special requests. We've got dinner tonight in Above, where it's a meet and greet. It's a special three-course menu. So, you know, we're doing, again, it's a bespoke menu for that event. So yeah, there's always something to be getting on with.
And so, I mean, you sound like you're a massive inspiration to your team. Who are the people that inspire you?
I think with a team, we've got a really good bunch. I wouldn't say it's, I think it'd be a bit much for me to not refute that a little bit, in that maybe we all feed off each other, and there's a really good chemistry between all the, yeah, myself, Josh on ground, Martin a development chef, Zach in pastry, our baker Slavo, James and Above. There's, you know, and then obviously sous chefs as well. Everyone kind of contributes with ideas, but at the end of the day, you know, there needs to be dishes that work for Hyde. Also, at the end of the day, it's myself that will get the bullets if they're not good enough. But so there's a good chemistry. So you just want to keep it positive, keep it light. In terms of inspiration for myself, I'd say first and foremost, anyone that's run their own business, you respect. The inspiration is more just when you get amazing produce through the door, that kind of keeps you inspired and keeps you honest, keeps the dishes simple. So I think the closer you are to the food itself, and the more you enjoy eating, I think the more you're just naturally going to have ideas. And I think with inspiration or coming up with new ideas, I think people either have lots of ideas or they don't have many at all. I think people fall into those categories, right, whether you're, you know, a musician, a chef, a writer. I think you're either prolific or you're not.
And so you received your star for Hyde in 2019. You must have been expecting that, right?
I wasn't. I'd like to say I was. Again, I'd have probably felt, you know, utterly gutted that we didn't get it. But given the size of the venue, and I think it was 5 months, so we didn't have a lot of time to get it. So yeah, I think I could appreciate it a lot more second time around. When Anne Dubu, I was maybe a little bit young, maybe a little bit raw. I had everything on the line. And the day that the Michelin star was announced, I think one of my fridges had broken. Two guys, one guy didn't come into work, one guy was late.
Oh, no.
I think I can't remember if we had a power cut as well. I can't remember. It was when there was a leak as well. So I found
a text message from Oscar.
Yeah, so I was sort of firefighting on the day. And we didn't really celebrate it as we should. And I feel more bad for my staff at the time that I wasn't probably happier than I should have been, because I was just preoccupied with getting through the day. Like I said, there was fridges, freezers going out. We were understaffed. It was just a horrible day. Whereas at Hyde, you know, there was the Michelin announcement, I was dressed up, we could enjoy it. And yeah, you know, could appreciate it in a different manner.
And how did you celebrate the second time round?
So I had had dinner with Evgeny, Tatiana and Matt, the GM, and Evgeny treated us some amazing wines. And no, it was really lovely. Yeah, having dinner in the restaurant, and I think Gordon Ramsay was actually in the private dining room next door. So yeah, no pressure on the kitchen that night.
Yeah, you got to keep that level up.
Yeah.
And what are you
I was hammered, but yeah, no, it was a fun night.
So, what are your ambitions for a second star?
Yeah, no, they are. You know, it's something that I'm open about. You know, I'd like Above to be viewed as a separate restaurant, and I'd like Above to win a second star. You know, obviously, I think it's worth it, but it's not my opinion that matters. But I've seen the evolution of what we've done. I'm honest enough and intelligent enough to recognise. Yeah, I think we keep improving, keep simplifying. Sophistication through simplicity, the dishes are more and more organic, and we execute them, I think, with more ease. That doesn't mean to sound arrogant, but obviously when you open kitchens new, and it takes a while to instill a culture, I think the dishes now are better than before, and we execute them, you know, more fluently than before. And that's how it should be. We should keep striving to be better, you know, better the next day than what we are today. And it's also very much in the psyche of a chef, and, you know, not just going for that consistency, but going for improvement. It's really important to question things, to question why we do things. You know, if we didn't do that, there'd be no propulsion, you know, to improve or to look for a better way of achieving something. So, yeah, I think it's important, aside from working hard in cooking, to work smart as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say has been the biggest highlight in your career to date?
The obvious ones would be, you know, opening up place with your name on the door and the Michelin star, but it's something that you need a bit of time to gain perspective. It's only now that I can look at a first restaurant, you know, and feel affectionate towards it, because it's, you know, it's in a picture frame, you know, and, you know, it's created by time. You can see it as its own entity and with a bit of perspective, rather than being, you know, completely kind of lost within it when you're working there. And it's a really love-hate relationship for the 6 years that I had it. I was going to say, it's just, I think we're in a good place at the moment. We've got a good bunch of guys. And I guess most crucially, right now, got an audience, you know, to cook for as such. So, you know, that's key. And it's, you know, it's obviously sad that, you know, for example, maybe some musicians or some actors or other creative fields don't have that. So I do feel grateful that we do. And, you know, I think every chef has, since coming back after doing all the home deliveries, has appreciates, you know, having a dining room to cook for.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I read somewhere on a totally different topic that you visited 10 Downing Street right at the beginning of your career, and you were like Thomas Keller and Farran Adria. That is pretty awesome.
It was really nice. Everyone's probably wondering who the hell I was and what I was doing there.
Well, they found that afterwards, because you got, was it Rising Star or?
It was amazing. It was one of these sort of iconic places that you see on the news, and Yeah, no, it was incredible to go there. And the lineup they had was ridiculous. But no, it was to do with sustainable restaurant agency that had coordinated it. So looking at how to make restaurants more sustainable. But yeah, like, felt felt surprised to be asked, but no, it's very interesting having a snoop around as such. Nothing you can take, unfortunately. There's no sort of memento or anything. It's just the memory of it.
Yeah, no,
it was nice. Have a little certificate or photo, a little photo in the lobby or something. I don't know.
Yeah, rubbing shoulders with Farron Adria. You're like,
yeah, none of that, unfortunately. Yeah, you couldn't take photos because but also there's a pigeonhole thing for your phones, yeah. Which I actually thought wasn't quite secure enough. you hand in your phone upon arrival, so no.
Yeah, but you can take pictures right outside the door, though.
Yeah, I don't think I did, stupidly. I think there are a lot of people doing it, but I didn't at the time. But I live really near it, funnily enough. So I walk past it often on my days off. I'll take my son to the park, and we walk past. It's actually a lovely view. You go through Horse Guards Parade into St James's Park, and there's a little bit, the sort of doorway isn't quite grand enough, but the sort of architectural aperture that sort of frames the park. And yes, we walk past the back garden of 10 Downing Street with my boy on his little scooter or whatever, scuttling away.
Oh, brilliant. You must have spent an amazing time with him over the last few months.
No difference to normal, to be honest. In lockdown, we had we were doing the takeaway, so we were actually living apart. So he was in the countryside for a few months because we live very central. Central London wasn't a fun place for him, and his nursery in Soho was shut temporarily. So I actually spent probably a bit less time in some ways, I was going to say it's. I guess the one good thing with Hyde is that there's a strength in depth here that means, you can, take a day off or evening off. There's a bit more flexibility when you have such a big team. I think, like I said, my role, whereas at Debut, I'd be trying to dress every plate of food almost. Here is more creating the culture or trying to kind of safeguard things so that in terms of the execution in the kitchen or the menus, whatever it may be, it's more than what a singular pair of hands can do. Yeah. You'd kill yourself rapidly if you're trying to do every service for somewhere that does 600 covers a day and is open 700 days, so seven days a week. It's you kind of need to, I guess, learn how to delegate and that you need to prioritise.
So, Ollie, we're coming to the end now. Just tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
I love cars and muscle cars in particular. So, sadly, recently sold, had a 69 Dodge Charger, matte black.
Oh, wow.
That's one thing.
Why'd you sell it?
just didn't use it enough. It was like the bucket list purchase, but like I said, when you live centrally, it was lying idle, really. So and I think other things. Second kid on the way. I guess that's not news, but going to be another boy in March. I don't do a great deal of social media or whatever. So yeah, I guess they're two facts that aren't in the ether as such.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's amazing news.
Pleasure.
And thank you so much for your time. And I'm actually really looking forward to your second cookbook because I've got your got your first one.
Amazing. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for and drawing it. I feel flattered.
It's beautiful. It's such a, it's a piece of art, this book.
I was going to say, better to look at than make dishes from. I think it kind of reminds you why restaurants exist. Yeah, you open up that book, there's going to be a hell of a lot of washing up. So,
yeah, that's an ornamental piece on my shelf.
It is. And the next one will be, it'll be, I think, a bit more dirty pages, should we say.
Well, next year is going to be a big year for you then. You've got two new places.
Well, Hideaway will be, I think, either late this year or early next. Then I think maybe number two in March. The book in September. But luckily, most of the work for the book is done now. So just crossing the T's and dotting the I's.
Well, best of luck for it. And it's been a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you so much. Likewise.
Thank you for your time. And guys, if you want to catch up with Ollie, with what Ollie's up to, you can find out at Hyde_restaurant on Instagram. And you can also see some of his really cool recipes there. He's actually making stuff for you. It's quite easy to follow. You can watch this interview on YouTube as well as Instagram and also on podcast. Thanks, Ollie. Take care.
Cheers. All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye.